Welcome to Novelist Spotlight, the podcast where published fiction writers are interviewed to gather their insights and writing lessons so we can use them to make ourselves better and more effective writers. Now, on with our program. This is your host, Mike Consul. Thank you for listening. In the spotlight is Heather Babcock.
Hello, my name is Heather Babcock, and I am from Toronto, Canada. I am a movie nerd. I am obsessed and have a passion for the movies of the early 1930s, in particular, what is known as the pre-code period in Hollywood. My debut novel, Filthy Sugar, was released with Inanna Publications in May of 2020. And it was inspired by the feisty dames of 1930s Hollywood films.
Well, and if you could see Heather Babcock right now, you would know she's quite a feisty dame herself. She's young, she's sultry, she's a redhead, and she cuts a silver screen silhouette, I have to tell you. She grabbed my attention on Instagram, as did her book cover. The name Filthy Sugar grabbed my attention, but then also the Art Deco cover of her novel was an attention grabber. So I started communicating with Heather through Instagram and have been waiting for many weeks, actually. I've been looking forward to this podcast, been corresponding with her for many weeks. So Heather, finally, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Let's dive into your novel a little bit, and we'll talk about your future plans, the inspiration for this book, the inspiration for your lifestyle, and as I say, your future plans. Let's start with the setting for Filthy Sugar in terms of time and place. I think you said the 1930s. You indicated 1930s.
Yes.
Is and what is the place? Where is it set?
So it's actually I created the world of Filthy Sugar. It is set in North America in. It takes place in 1 year, starting in 1934. And my protagonist lives in the poor section of the city, which she calls the world behind the market. And that's where a lot of the family story takes place.
So 1934, and it's a year in the life of your protagonist.
1934 to 1935.
Okay. So a year in the life of your protagonist, whose name is?
Her name is Wanda Whittle, and she becomes a burlesque dancer, and her stage name is Wanda Wiggles.
Interesting. So talk a little bit about what she does for a living other than burlesque. She's got another job, does she not?
So at the beginning of the book, she works in a department store as a mannequin, which is what they called models back then. So she models fur coats, and this is really a world away from where she lives because she lives with her mother and her sister in a rooming house in the world behind the market. Her mother and her sister work in a glove factory. And so Wanda takes two trolley rides every morning to this fancy department store and models these luxurious fur coats.
And this department store is a real department store, or is this a product of the author's imagination?
It's a product of my imagination. The department store is called Blondell's Department Store, and I named it after Joan Blondell, who is a very prolific, wonderful actress. Particularly in the 1930s, she's the queen of pre-code movies, so I wanted to pay her a little tribute there.
Talk about the characters who surround Wanda. Who are the main characters who revolve around her during this tale?
So there is her sister, who's very important to the novel, her sister Evelyn, who, unlike Wanda, so Wanda's obsessed with the movies, she is obsessed with glamour. Her sister Evelyn is very into workers' rights, which is another part of, I wanted to kind of show what was going on in the, at the time, so kind of exposed the glitter and the grit of the 1930s. And Evelyn is the grit. So she's all for workers' rights. She works in a glove factory. And she can be very critical of Wanda's lifestyle. Another important character is Mr. Manchester, who owns the Applebottom Burlesque Theater, and he discovers Wanda while she is modeling fur coats in the department store and changes her life.
So is he the guy who suggests that she gets involved in the theater and burlesque?
Yes.
And is that her sister takes umbrage to the way she makes a living? Is it the modeling or is it the burlesque that, or both, that she takes exception
to? So her sister doesn't judge Wanda for what she's doing. She respects that she's a burlesque dancer, but she doesn't like that the way she's being used by, like, how these men are making money off of her. She feels that Wanda and the other dancers should unionize and you know, because they're the ones doing all the work, that they should be reaping the profits.
So Mr. Manchester is one of these men who are taking advantage of her in her sister's estimation. Is that right?
In her sister's estimation. Her sister is all for workers' rights. And we know, like, workers, you know, that was a huge concern in the 1930s. This is when, you know, people died for the minimum wage for 40-hour work week. And so this was really at the top of people's minds. And someone like Evelyn, who's out there protesting and very much concerned with the way that workers were being treated at the time. And, of course, that's relevant today, too.
Yes, yes. So now there has to be a love interest in any story of this kind. So who is a love interest in Filthy Sugar? Is Mr. Manchester, does he become Wanda's love interest in addition to her employer?
So she becomes very obsessed with him. She thinks that she loves him. She's obsessed with him. Wanda is very sexually free, without thinking about it, without putting a label on it. So she does have quite a few lovers in the book, and she does find love by the end of the book. It's not with someone who she pictured herself being with. My protagonist, she is bisexual, so who she eventually, I won't give anything away, but she does have lovers, both male and female. And she does find love at the end of the book.
And she's at the Applebottom Burlesque Theater where she's doing the burlesque shows.
Yes. That's where she becomes Wanda Wiggles.
Wanda Wiggles. Okay, so that's her stage name there. So, you know, you say that among the people who have an impact on Wanda's life are cowardly boxers, shady coppers, dime store hoodlums, and painted ladies. A painted lady being a prostitute, is that right? I'm thinking of Elton John's song, Sweet Painted Lady. Are painted ladies prostitutes?
Right. Yes.
It is, okay. Which also leads us to the title. I should have asked this earlier. Filthy Sugar, it's an intriguing title, but that phrase means something. I know you've told me before, but for our listeners' edification, Filthy Sugar means what?
So Filthy Sugar means dirty money, and that's a slang that I made up for the novel. While I was working on the novel, I was constantly listening to 1930s music, watching films from the early 1930s, reading books from the 1930s. So I was really immersed in that time period. And what really struck me was how much fun people back then were having with language. The slang of the period was a hoot. It was just like, it was super fun. So I include a glossary in the back of Filthy Sugar. There's a lot of authentic 1930s slang, but I also made up some of my own slang for the book, and Filthy Sugar being one of the terms that I made up just because I was so inspired by how much fun people were having back then with the language.
Interesting. So you've got a glossary. Give us a couple or three terms or phrases that are in the book that are from the time period, and then give us like the definition.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. There's a phrase "swing a hoof," which means to dance. Swell is used a lot. Of course, if you watch a 1930s movie, you hear swell, like, oh, that's swell, which means that's cool. That was like the cool of the 1930s. Mm-hmm. City juice is tap water.
City juice is tap water. Interesting. Okay.
City juice, yeah, is tap water.
You know, I do know that the book's description talks about Wanda experiencing a sexual awakening. Now, you just told us she's a bisexual, which would indicate that she's already sexually awakened in a way that many people are not. So in what way does a sexual awakening happen? Or is this a spoiler alert? Is this something you really shouldn't talk about for people who haven't read the book yet?
A little bit of a spoiler alert. It is more it's more near the end of the novel. As the novel progresses, she owns her sexuality more, because at the beginning of the novel, she's really kind of caught in the male gaze, if you will, where she is being defined in her life, and she starts to define herself and her sexuality on her own terms as the book progresses.
Okay, so let me ask you about autobiographical elements to this, because you're into movies, Wanda's into movies, she's quite the dresser, you're quite the dresser, I know that from the images on your website and also in Instagram. So how much of this is autobiographical? I know authors get asked that all the time, and to some extent, any novel's got autobiographical elements to it. But it does sound a little bit memoirish in that it plays to your passions, at least some of your passions. I probably shouldn't ask this question right after the bisexual interchange. But
it is more, it's not really autobiographical. It is mostly a product of part my imagination and part just my passion, because I have always had a passion for classic movies, and discovering the pre-code movies, I just was, you know, blown away by the movies of this time period before the enforcement of the Motion Picture Production Code. So before censorship took effect in the very early 1930s, you'll see and hear things in black and white movies that you're not used to seeing or hearing in a black and white movie. So that really took me by surprise and definitely inspired the novel. I wouldn't say a lot of it is really, I mean, Wanda is completely a product of my imagination. I wish I could be as fearless as she is and as outspoken as she is. She might be who I want to be. She just really just does not care what other people think. Just says says whatever she wants, does whatever she wants, and she's to me inspiring that way.
Is she a likable character?
Certainly not.
Do you think readers will see her as a likable character?
She is. Okay, I don't. She wouldn't be in a Hallmark movie.
I
wouldn't call her a likable character. She definitely is a little too hard for that. I think she's hard-boiled, to use a term from the period. She's a hard-boiled dame. So she's probably more like, and she's definitely inspired by a character that Jean Harlow plays in a movie called Red-Headed Woman, where she's this very selfish, hedonistic character who's funny too. And definitely I wanted, not that I don't think Wanda is completely selfish, but she can be selfish, as I think we all can be. So definitely I didn't write her to be, a perfectly likable young girl. She's a little feisty, definitely rough around the edges, I think.
So she's a redhead, you said, is that right?
She is a redhead, yeah.
So she's a redhead, you're a redhead. She has a passion for the movies. You have a passion for the movies.
Yes. So I guess there could be some biographical
element in that. Yeah, she's a very sharp dresser. And now you live in Toronto, which is a beautiful, clean city. You're not the what would she call it? Life. She lives behind the market or something.
She calls where she lives the world behind the market.
The world behind the market. Okay. Well, Toronto's not like that. I know you live in much better climes than that.
Parts of Toronto are like that.
Yeah, the parts that you don't trade in, I'm sure. But talk a little bit about your passion for classic films. I mean, you even like the old silent films. Is that right?
I love silent movies. Yes, we're lucky in Toronto that we do still have a lot of old theaters, theaters that have been around since the 1900s, and a lot of those theaters will still play silent movies, which is really cool. Who got me into classic movies was my dad. He was born in 1931, and the first movie that he ever saw in the theater when it first came out was The Wizard of Oz with Judy Garland. And I just think if you have a choice of what your first movie ever is going to be, I think you're pretty lucky if it's The Wizard of Oz. Mm-hmm. So I know for him, he didn't have a very easy childhood. His dad was schizophrenic, and that, of course, back in those days, like, that wasn't something you talked about. So his home life could be rather difficult, and I think he escaped to the movies, and then eventually escaped to the Navy and joined the Canadian Navy. But so the movies were always very important to him, and the movies became important to me too, and it was something that we could share. When I was a teenager, I went through the typical teenager phase where I was pretty difficult, and I think the way that he found he could communicate with me was through the movies. I remember one Christmas he gave me a bunch of VHS tapes of Audrey Hepburn movies like Breakfast at Tiffany's, Sabrina, Roman Holiday. I think he just knew that I needed some Audrey in my life. And one of my favorite memories of when I was a teenager with my dad was I would go to the movies a lot by myself. I was a loner as a teenager. And I remember one afternoon he said, well, can I give you a lift? Because I was going out, can I give you a lift somewhere? And I said, yeah, I'm going to the movies. And he said, well, do you mind if I come with you? And I was like, okay. And we saw Muriel's Wedding together. And I can't remember how old I was, but I was a teenager. And I just remember that we really bonded in a way that we hadn't in a long time. We were laughing together and we were talking about the movie afterwards. And it's just a really special memory for me.
Now, you are an only child or not?
No, my sister, I have a sister, she passed away about a decade ago, but so it was me and my sister.
Okay. The reason I ask is because you said you were a loner, and what made you a loner, do you think?
I don't know, I just really liked spending time on my own, and I would skip school to go to the library and just read books. or again, go to the movies.
I think a lot of writers are loner. I mean,
pardon?
A loner. I think a lot of writers are loners in that they like to be in their head a lot, which means, and to be in your head, you need to be away from people because they end up talking to you and to kind of disrupting that silence that a writer generally values to really contemplate what they want to write about next, or just spending time in their own head. I mean, that's kind of common. Why silent films? Because I think a lot of people would figure a silent film, that's such a huge element that's missing. There's no dialogue. You've written a novel and plan to write more, and which has everything to do with communicating in words. Talk about the appeal of silent movies.
So silent movies, they're not missing sound any more than black and white movies are missing color. Silent movies are an art form upon themselves, and they are there's a lot of communication in silent films. It's done with title cards, with gestures, facial expressions, particularly the eyes. There's an actress from that period, Louise Brooks, another Clara Bow, and they were just able to communicate this wide range of emotions just in their eyes. It's really incredible. And I think anyone who hasn't seen a silent movie really should, you know, rethink it and should check them out. I think they'd be surprised because they're quite emotionally engaging. And the thing about a silent movie is you really do have to give the film your full attention, because of course if you just look away you can miss something. Silent films too, they were so universal. So back then, you know, a movie could be from any country, could play anywhere in the world exactly, you know, it just because of that universal language of body language and facial expressions. There's also the music is extremely important to a silent movie. If you can get out to see a silent movie in the theaters where they have live piano accompaniment or organ accompaniment, it really makes all the difference. The music is a character within itself in a silent movie.
So if somebody wanted to experience that and had never seen a silent movie, I would imagine they can find them on YouTube, right?
Yeah, and I think, for me personally, I think silent movies, they really, it's sad because they hit their, you know, their artistic, I guess, they just became so artistic, and they at the height of their game, right? That right before talkies came in. So probably in my humble opinion, the best silent movies are from 1927, 1928, which is just before sound started to dominate. And there's films like you know, if you like the movie Clueless, there's a movie called Our Dancing Daughters with Joan Crawford, and it was the film that made Joan Crawford a star. And I think it's from 27 or 28, but it's like the Clueless of its day. And I think anyone who likes the movie Clueless would love Our Dancing Daughters. Or there's the film Wings with Clara Bow, which is a World War One movie, which I believe that's from 1927. And anyone who loves war movies, you're going to love Wings. It's an incredible movie. The comedies from that period, I've been in the theater and watching a Mabel Normand comedy or a Charlie Chaplin comedy, and there's little kids there, and they are just on the floor laughing. Like, these comedies are just so, you know, timeless. So I definitely, you know, I've introduced friends to silent movies, and it's a treat to see someone who is like, oh, I don't want to watch a silent movie. And then they, you know, a friend of mine, I convinced her to come and see Safety Last, which is a Harold Lloyd film, and she was laughing, and she's like, that was really funny. I didn't think it would be so funny. I didn't think a silent movie could be so entertaining. And yeah, so it's a treat to see when people give these movies a chance, how wonderful and timeless they are.
Interesting. Yeah, now you got me interested. I'm going to have to check that out. You know, and I've got a mother-in-law who's hard of hearing, but she likes to watch movies. I think a silent movie would be perfect for her.
Yeah, there you go. Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. Now, listen, you've started a novel writing career, but you love movies, and they go hand in hand, but why novels rather than movies? Or are your aspirations broader than just novels? Are you also thinking in terms of writing screenplays for the big screen,
Oh, that would be amazing. It's not something I'm pursuing right now. It is something I am thinking about. I'd love to, you know, study film history. I mean, I've been doing so on my own, but I'd love to, you know, actually, you know,
do it more
professionally
formally.
Study film history. Yeah, and, you know.
And maybe write a screenplay
one day. That is something I might pursue in the future. In the future that might be. I recently spoke at the Vintage Film Festival, which is in Canada, in Port Hope, Ontario, and that was a lot of fun. And I was talking about the woman of pre-code gangster movies. So that was a real treat.
Talk about your decision to write Filthy Sugar. What inspired it?
It's a couple of things. So I knew that I've always been a fan of burlesque. There used to be not so much, well, I guess there probably still is now, but things were, you know, slowed down because of the pandemic. But in Toronto, I've seen some burlesque shows. I've always been a fan of Betty Page, and she has her Wiggle movies, which, of course, that inspired Wanda Wiggles, stage name. And then just watching these old movies, The Broadway Melody, 42nd Street, the 1930s Let's Put on a Show films, just really, I thought, I'd like to write something that's set in the show business world of the 1930s. And I thought, well, to have it in a burlesque theater, that's a little more, I guess, more relatable, more down to earth than, you know, Hollywood, right? So this is my own made up world, with some real elements. And,
Let's say Filthy Sugar grabs the attention of a movie director, and it's going to be turned into a movie. Who would play Wanda Whittle, and who would play Mr. Manchester? Have you ever thought about that?
You know, John Hamm would be great as Mr. Manchester.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm totally on board with that. He'd be perfect.
Totally.
Because I'm thinking maybe Jennifer Lawrence.
I think a newcomer would be probably better. Because she is 19, so probably would have to go to a newcomer. I can't really think of anyone right now. I mean, certainly she was inspired by Jean Harlow, Joan Crawford, you know, these actresses of the day. But definitely Mr. Manchester, John Hamm. I totally see that.
So now your dad was an inspiration for your love of movies. What were your early literary inspirations?
Since I was 3 years old, since I was 2 years old, actually, I've been going to the library, and, you know, some of my early, and I think every redheaded Canadian girl will say Anne of Green Gables, and that's definitely one of my favorite books. But as I got older, I discovered the work of Hubert Selby Jr., who wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn and Requiem for a Dream. Requiem for a Dream, which really had an effect on me, just as a human, just on my life, had this effect. And I think anyone who, I would recommend that book to anybody. The books of Toni Morrison, such as The Bluest Eye, that's another like incredibly powerful book that just to this, you know, I read it over 10 years ago, and to this day, I think about it just like, you know, just a lot. And I do hope to one day, I would strive to write anything that was a quarter as powerful as either of those books. I mean, they're just, those are the kind of books that just make you want to be a better human being. And I've always, even with lighter books too, I always love the way that I could be going through something and maybe I could pick up something that, unlike the books I just mentioned, but would be, you know, lighter books that would be considered more fluffy or whatever, but could just help me escape. And that's just something really special because, you know, when you're reading a book, you're in your own world and yeah, it can take you away from what's going on in your real life.
Yeah, isn't it George R. R. Martin who said, "The reader lives a thousand lives. The non-reader lives only one."
I like that.
Talk about, now you can take the Fifth Amendment on any question I ask you, Heather, but I'm curious, talk about your own lifestyle and what it is today and what you want it to be tomorrow. Not literally tomorrow, but you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. Is that a fair question?
Yeah, no, that's a fair question. I don't know, I'm just going to keep learning. I always, I'm glad that there are so many things that I don't know because I look forward to discovering them. You know, just learning more about film history. I'm going to really start, I've been working on the beginnings of a new novel, and I'm really going to get serious about that in the new year.
What is your next novel? What are you going to be a writer in a time period? Are you going to always be in the 30s? Are you always going to be doing period pieces? Will you be writing contemporary books?
No,
what's your next one?
My next novel is going to be set in modern times. And it's probably, from what I've been working on so far, it's probably going to be a bit darker than Filthy Sugar to write, and I hope it's fun. I've been told it's a lot of fun to read, so my next novel will probably be a little more darker, I think, but I can't say a lot about it yet because it's still in its baby stages.
Would you is your protagonist going to be a woman again? Is it going to be an interesting, an interesting and free-spirited woman, perhaps? Or maybe a little bit devious, since it's going to be darker, or she's going to have devious people around her. Obviously, yes, you don't want to give away too much right now. Let's talk about your social media strategy, or whether you have a social media strategy. You are on social media. You post regularly. And would you say you have a strategy, or is it just that you're active there?
When Filthy Sugar came out, it came out in May of 2020, which was right, you know, just a couple of months, or less than a couple of months into the pandemic, at the very beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I, you know, before that, both myself and my publisher, like, everything was we were planning in-person events, And that, of course, changed everything. And I realized that I needed to become, I already had a Facebook, I had a Tumblr, but I realized I needed to become a lot more active on social media because everything moved online. So I joined Instagram, and I'm very thankful to Val Fuller, who is the designer of my book cover with Inanna Publications. She did such a great job, and I'm so thankful to her because that cover is so photogenic, and it looks great on Instagram. Mm-hmm. So I was able to, have some fun. There's different, like discovering the different hashtags on Instagram, like on Wednesdays we read pink and Filthy Sugar is pink. So a lot of times on Wednesdays when I was promoting it, I would, post something on Instagram on Wednesdays we read pink. I'm lucky that the book has a lot of, there's the 1930s angle, there's the Hollywood stars angle, that kind of thing that I could post about. And I have, I've had people that I don't know who I just met through Instagram who would suddenly post and like that they bought the book, and like they would post a picture of themselves holding the book or something. I'd be like, wow, that's cool. Like that was just through Instagram. So definitely it was really helpful to me.
Good to hear. So the Historical Novel Society called Filthy Sugar an extremely sensual work of art, themes exquisitely written by Heather Babcock. The characters are real and raw. Do you think that characterizes the book well? I mean, were you shooting for the sensuality?
Yeah, I love that review. I was so happy when I read. I mean, of course, being a, when you get a review like that, it's just so wonderful. And the woman who reviewed my book for the Historical Novel Society, she got it. Like, she really got what I was doing, that combining the glitter and the grit of the 1930s. And I really, really appreciated her thoughtful review very much.
What was the hardest part about writing Filthy Sugar? Was there any element to the whole writing process or telling the story that you found to be particularly difficult?
A lot of it was finding at the time that I was writing it, I don't work in this job anymore, but at the time I was working shifts, a lot of shift work where I would be working late at night and then having to come back early in the morning. So I had to make a real effort to devote time to my book. So I think that was the major obstacle that I had to overcome, was to make time to write it and to finish it. And one of the things, unfortunately, my social life really suffered. I actually lost friends because I needed to devote time to writing this book, and I just couldn't commit myself socially the way that I had before.
So describe a good day of writing for you. I mean, how many words, how many pages, is it a quantitative or qualitative thing for you?
Okay, yeah, for me it's about quality. So a great day could be I wake up with a line. A lot of times that's how I'll start it. I'll think of something, just a line, and it will just set me off, and I'll start writing. And it doesn't have to be a lot of pages for me. I mean, I think it's a successful day for me is if I write a paragraph or a page that I'm really happy with. I don't really judge it by like how many words I wrote that day or even how many pages. Just more the quality. Even if I just wrote the other day, I wrote just a few lines, and I was just so happy with it. And it was just something that came to me when I was, you know, I like to go for long walks, and a lot of times that's when I'll be inspired or something will come to me. And yeah, so that's really it. Or in, I love writing outside. I just feel that writing can be a very spiritual thing. So as corny as that sounds, but just being out in nature, just really helps me to feel more connected, with my work. And I always write my first draft with pen and paper, and then I do the editing on the computer. But first draft has to be pen and paper. I could never do it any other way.
Why is that? Is there a particular reason? Is there something that you can put voice to?
I don't know exactly. I've always been that way, but I think I just feel more connected, and it feels more organic. Another bonus is that, you know, I have the proof that, like, if I write something and then I cross it out and then I write something else and then I'll write something else and cross that out. But then I can go back and look at what I crossed out and be like, hey, that actually worked the first time. Mm-hmm. So that definitely, from an editing perspective, that helps. And also just because I love writing outdoors or on the subway, there's no, when you're writing just with a pen and paper, there's no technical difficulties, right? Unless your pen runs out of ink. So
right.
That.
Yeah. You don't need to worry about, battery power, internet connections, or any of that stuff. What is the best piece of writing you ever received?
Piece of writing, like, I ever read, you mean, or?
No. Whether it was a piece of writing advice that somebody told you or that you read somewhere. What?
Oh yes.
Yeah. Okay. What would that be?
A very, very talented author. She's also an author with Inanna Publications. Her name is Lisa DeNicolitz, and she actually has a new book out called "Everything You Dream Is Real," which I can't wait to read. She's a wonderful author, and she gave a piece of writing advice on her Goodreads, which really stayed with me. She said, give yourself the goal to write one sentence a day, at least one sentence a day. So that way, if you only write one sentence that day, you're not beating yourself up. And of course, you can write more. You don't have to only write one sentence. But if you do just write one sentence, then, you know, as Lisa says, a book is made up of a lot of sentences. So be proud of yourself if you did that. So that, I thought that was a wonderful piece of advice. And I've told her that a couple of times, you know, that really helped me.
It takes the pressure off too, don't you think? Because if you sit down and you realize I only need to really write one sentence, but you're almost inevitably going to write a lot more than that.
Exactly. And that's what Lisa says, right? So you're exactly just as, you know, it takes the pressure off. You're not going to beat yourself up and be like, I didn't write this many words. But, and I mean, certainly the one perfect sentence is like beats the whole page of, you know, like
of gibberish.
Something that, yeah. So I've always kept that in mind, and that certainly helped me while I was working on Filthy Sugar, that I kept Lisa's advice in my head as I was doing that. And so even if there was a day when, you know, I could only write one sentence or one paragraph, or even if just an idea, like what kind of clothes does your character wear? What kind of music does your character listen to? Like that, something like that, you're working on your book. It doesn't necessarily mean that you finish writing five chapters in one day. Every little bit that you do contributes to the finished product.
Right. So who is your trusted reader? When let's say you've written a chapter, you think it's pretty much there, but you want an outside opinion. Do you have a person that you turn to that's kind of your trusted reader or first read?
Probably my partner. Although usually I will show him things that I've just written, and it's something I'm proud of, and I say, oh, I just wrote this, you know, let me know what you think. With Filthy Sugar, though, it's funny because I wrote Filthy Sugar, and I worked on it for years, and I sent it to Inanna Publications, which was the publisher of my choice, and then I sat back and thought, crossed my fingers, hoped that they would accept it, but no one else had read it up until that point, so I didn't have any readers for. I mean, I could have, I just chose not to.
You trusted yourself.
I trusted myself. Yeah, and I do think I know a lot of writers, they prefer to have readers, and that's great. I do think that sometimes there is the saying, too many cooks, and I do think that writers have to be careful about that. Like there is a pitfall of showing your work to too many people and getting too many opinions that might take away from your original vision, and I do think at the end of the day, you do have to trust yourself.
Yeah, well, I agree 100% because I think sometimes people get in these writers groups and one person has an opinion or suggestions and somebody's got a countervailing opinion. So it's like, what are you supposed to do with that? You can be bouncing back and forth on that sort of thing. Not that it isn't a good thing to have a skilled reader. Absolutely it is. But as you say, if you have too many voices, you're not going to have two or three people all saying the same thing unless it's just an obvious faux pas in the copy that needs to be addressed. So so what comes next? You got this novel that you're working on. Do you already think in terms, are you thinking beyond that? Do you keep notes as to some other book ideas, or are you strictly thinking in terms of this next one and you have no idea what you'll do beyond that?
So right now I'm definitely going to focus on this next one, and I've always been that kind of writer, I guess. I like to focus on the one project. When I'm at work in my day job, I have to do a lot of multitasking, but in my writing, I'd rather just keep it focused on and
do you not sometimes read a book though? Do you not sometimes read another novel and then think, I really like this approach and I want to do something like it, and then there's an idea and you go ahead and you salt that one away for future?
I can see that. I have piles and piles of notebooks in my apartment, and I have gone back to them and created new work out of discarded work from my past. So I definitely see what you're saying.
You know, and I've done that, and it can be a distraction because if you're working on something, I know in my own experience I could be working on something that's not going well. And then I start thinking about this other idea, and maybe I should be doing that because that one sounds, I feel like I really have drawn a bead on that one. So it can be a real distraction. It can end up giving the monkey mind an excuse to jump to something else. So probably better off, just staying focused on the project you got, because there's all kinds of mind games that go on with writing, at least in my experience, a lot of mind games. Well, our guest has been Heather Babcock. She's the author of Filthy Sugar, that is 1930 slang for dirty money. Heather, thank you for taking the time. Congratulations on the book, and I wish you best
thank
of luck
you,
with your next one, which you expect, you're going to start writing it in earnest, you said, starting with the new year. Are you figuring what's your timeline on that? Are you figuring, I don't know if you do New Year's resolutions, but maybe your resolution is to have it completed by the end of 2023. Is that realistic? Or do you write fast enough to get a book done in a year?
No. I did with Filthy Sugar, I actually did give myself a timeline. And that's because of the job that I was working in. I had to make the time with the shift work and everything, and I did give myself a timeline. But with this book, I think as a lot, with a lot of people, the pandemic really changed me, and I realize now, you can't really plan for anything, and I'm just going to go with the flow. So
how did it change you?
Pardon?
How did it change you, the pandemic?
I'm a lot more easygoing now, or at least I like to think so. I used to get really hung up on deadlines and that kind of thing, and now I realize like things might not work out the way that you expected, but you just go with it and you just take another path. So,
gotcha.
If I'm lucky that I finish my book at the end of 2023, that's great, but it might take me 5 more years. It might take me 10 more years. I don't know, but I'll just go with it and see where it goes.
How long did Filthy Sugar take from start to finish?
So I started writing Filthy Sugar in the fall of 2015, and I finished it. I finished it and sent it off to Inanna Publications in December of 2017.
Okay, well, a couple years there, right? Did you say 2015 to 2017? Okay. Well, the great Tom Wolfe he was on a timeline where he was doing a novel every 11 years. I mean, so.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he took a lot of time to write those books. They were great, but they were time consuming. They took a long time to get them done. And he had the luxury of being able to spend his full time writing his books. And there's many authors who are that way as well. It takes years for them to turn out a book. So. Again, our guest has been Heather Babcock. And Heather, I wish you best of luck on the new one. And
thank you.
I'll look forward to staying in touch with you on Instagram. I appreciate you coming on the program.
Me too. Thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate it. I had a great time.